Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain at the hidden world of monetary control, control that determines global economic winners and losers and who benefits. Ellen Brown is a lawyer, scholar, and best-selling author of Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution. She's the founder of the Public Banking Institute and a prolific contributor to the growing discussion about the evolving world of economic theory. Later in the program, we'll take a look at new developments within the public banking movement. But now, here's Ellen. Money, get away.
Thanks, Walt. Today we're going to spend some more time with the leading voice for the use of eminent domain to help cities recover from a rash of foreclosures and impending foreclosures that has put them in serious economic distress. Things are starting to heat up in that area, including serious consideration of the idea in Wall Street's own hometown, New York. I'll be talking again with Professor Bob Hockett, who will be discussing the legal particulars and developments in the eminent domain approach. Other items of interest in the news include that the U.S. GDP has now sunk into negative territory. That means that all the government's deficit spending and all the Fed's quantitative easing have failed. A major reason for this is the underwater mortgage problem that we'll be talking about today. 40% of U.S. mortgages are either underwater or nearly so, meaning the home is worth less than what is owed on it. The Fed has been madly buying up mortgage-backed securities in its quantitative easing program, but all it has succeeded in doing is to prop up big bank balance sheets, once again showing that the Fed is working for the big banks, not for us. We'll be foregoing our public banking report today to focus entirely on this evolving eminent domain issue. We've got some inside information on it suggesting it will be the talk of the town soon as more major players get into the act. There have been some exciting developments in the battle between the big banks and desperate communities trying to get out of their mortgage debt grip. Today to tell us about it is Professor Bob Hockett, who originated the Eminent Domain Plan for Rescuing Underwater Homeowners. Bob is a graduate of Yale Law School and Oxford University and currently teaches law at Cornell Law School. He is clerk for the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Tenth Circuit and does regular consulting work for the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, the International Monetary Fund, the Occupy Cooperative, and a number of federal and state legislators and local government. Welcome, Bob.
Hi, Ellen. Thanks so much. It's so great to be with you again.
So this is the second time I've had the pleasure of interviewing you. When we talked before, it was all about the eminent domain plan boldly being pursued by Mayor Gail McLaughlin in Richmond, California. Mm-hmm. Now it seems that the plan is being introduced in a much bigger arena. Can you give us an update on that and describe how the plan would work?
Yeah, sure. So a good many cities, in addition to Richmond, are now looking at the plan. We could end up seeing out of California either multiple cities acting individually to deal with their own local underwater loan and foreclosure problems by adopting, again, one or another variation of the plan. Or we might see some cities joining together in California under a single structure that's known as a Joint Powers Authority, or JPA. And essentially what a JPA is a means by which multiple cities can kind of pool their efforts and thereby act more efficiently and save administrative costs and labor and the like. Then we'll probably see coalitions of cities in California working through JPA structures.
Can you describe how the plan would work?
Yeah, sure. So the basic idea of the eminent domain plan is this. There are a large number of mortgage loans, home mortgage loans, that are deeply underwater in some cities in the country. What that means is that the borrowers owe much more on those loans than the homes that they purchased with the loans are now worth after the housing price crash, right? So during the bubble, you know, before the crash, home prices were very much inflated. The problem was that it did turn out to be a bubble. And so once that bubble burst, all these people who had to borrow a lot in order to buy a home now suddenly found themselves owing you know, on the original loans, even though the homes were worth much less. The reason that that's important is that deeply underwater loans tend to go into delinquency, default, and foreclosure at just alarmingly high rate. The default rate is pretty close to around 70% for, say, the deepest underwater loan. Now, what that means in turn is that it's typically in the interest of the creditor as well as the debtor to write down the principal on those underwater loans to bring the principal more into sync with the value of the property. In other words, you want to render the loan no longer underwater. You want to raise it up above water, so to speak, by lowering the principal that's owed on the loan, thereby eliminating the so-called negative equity or the so-called debt overhang. Doing that ends up being a good idea for the creditor as well as the debtor, because in doing it, you almost eliminate the default risk, and that means you raise the expected value of the loan. You actually improve the value of the loan by writing down what's owed on it, because if it's a sustainable debt, it will ultimately be paid. Typically, what that means in turn is that when a creditor is able to write down a deeply underwater loan, the creditor does do so. But here's where the problem comes in. This particular group of loans, known as the private label securitized mortgage loan, the overwhelming majority of the deeply underwater loans are, in fact, these private label securitized loans. And the problem with these is that the creditor cannot write them down. It's structurally impossible for anybody actually to write them down, at least for any private party. The creditors, or also known as the bondholders in this case, can't do it because they're scattered all over the world. And in any event, they don't have control of the loans. The way the securitization arrangement works is to put control of the loans in the hands of a trustee who is contractually barred from writing down the loans or from selling them to anybody who can write them down. So we've got this kind of weird catch-22 sort of situation now. It's almost like a, you know, proverbial perfect storm of essentially poor planning and poor contract drafting. We've got this crazy sort of leftover situation where you've got loans that, if they were written down, could benefit both creditor and debtor, but that have no way of being written down. So the eminent domain plan is basically based on that premise. It's essentially aimed at solving that particularly thorny problem. And the way it works, it starts by noticing that there's only one way to get past a contract that hurts everybody, a contract that now functions as a kind of de facto suicide pact. There's only one legal authority by which you can circumvent a contract like that, and that is the government's power of eminent domain. That's the only way to do it. So what the plan calls for is for local governments that have large concentrations of underwater loans associated with properties in their jurisdictions to raise money from bondholders themselves, right? The creditors who would like to write down the loans but can't, to raise money from them, use that money to buy the loans compulsorily out of the securitization trusts that they're locked in and pay fair value for them as it has to when it uses eminent domain, but to pay that fair value with the money that's been supplied by the bondholders, to buy those loans out of the trusts, then write them down, write down the principal on them in order to render them sustainable. And in doing that, again, ironically, the governments will be benefiting both the creditors and the debtors, both the bondholders and the homeowners. And in doing that, moreover, it's going to help all sorts of innocent third parties as well, because all the data indicates that when homes are foreclosing in a particular neighborhood, even people whose homes are not underwater, even people who might own their homes outright without owing anything on them anymore, see their property prices take a hit because property values are affected, of course, by neighboring properties.
I didn't quite understand the part about that. So the bondholders are putting up the money. Aren't they putting up the money twice then?
It kind of looks that way, right? But that's essentially because we're talking about a securitization arrangement that sort of interposes an intermediary between the bondholder and the debtor, right? The homeowner and the bondholder, or the creditor and the debtor. So here's what I mean. I think to make things sort of more simple at first, think in terms of a loan that is not securitized. Think of what I like to call a Jimmy Stewart loan, where you've got a community bank that's locally responsive. It makes loans to other people in the community to buy homes. And then it keeps those loans in its own portfolio, and then it receives monthly payments from the borrowers. And then over time, you know, the debt is paid down, and then eventually it's extinguished, and the homeowner owns the home outright without owing anybody. In a case like that, if the loan were to go deeply underwater, the bank would typically write down the loan. It would enter into some kind of a workout arrangement with the borrower, and it would write down the total that's owed on the loan. And in effect, it would be taking a cut. It would be taking a hit, but it would be taking that hit in order to avoid an even bigger hit. Writing the loan down, of course, is to acknowledge that you're going to lose some of the money you were originally expecting on the loan. But you do it as a bank in order to avoid losing even more, which is what happens if the loan defaults. So the first step is, in effect, the bondholder buys the loan out of the trust. They are paying themselves less than the face value of the loan, but that's just another way of saying that they're writing the loan down. So the bondholder, in effect, buys the loan from him or herself, then writes it down, but keeps that loan, and the loan is now worth more than it was before because it's more likely to be paid, right? There's no longer a default risk. Then the loans are reconveyed, right, to whoever has supplied that money that's been used to buy those loans out of the trust. The new loan that is reconveyed to those people is worth more than the old loan that was purchased out of the trust. And that's the sense in which it ends up being better for the creditor as well as being better for the debtor.
I would like to get to the exciting developments in New York because I thought we had exciting developments.
So now, as you described earlier, Richmond, California is the first city in the country to have decided to move forward on precisely this plan, a plan of precisely this sort. They've been working on it for a little over a year now. But as noted before, other California cities are now coming online as well. They might join together and they might not. We'll just sort of see what happens there. Meanwhile, in other parts of the country, the same thing has been happening. So in New Jersey, the city of Irvington, New Jersey, which is it's a small city very close to Newark, voted last summer to move forward on a plan like this. And then this past May, just a little over a month ago, the city of Newark, New Jersey, you know, fairly large, substantial city, decided to move forward on the plan as well. And then finally, just this past week, on Wednesday of last week, four city council members of New York City, along with some housing advocacy organizations and community groups and myself, all gathered on the front steps of the New York City Hall and called upon the city to follow the lead of Newark and of Richmond and of other cities and to move forward on this plan, or at the very least to begin serious study of it with a view possibly to embracing it and adopting it and moving on it. So to have four city council members officially call on the Fuller City Council and on the mayor to conduct or initiate a serious study of this plan and ultimately move on it is, I think, a particularly significant development, of course, right, for a number of reasons. One, of course, New York tends to be a leader nationally. What New York City does often ends up being a kind of a groundbreaking movement that other cities follow. Secondly, of course, it's by far the largest city in the country. Third, of course, this is where Wall Street is, right? And certain Wall Street interests have been among the principal opponents of this plan. And my guess is that if there's one city that's not particularly afraid of Wall Street, it's the city that, in effect, owns Wall Street, right? And it's, of course, the city whose mayor and city council were elected without the support of Wall Street. So they're not beholden to, they don't owe Wall Street. And so I think that's another sense in which it's particularly interesting and exciting, of course, that New York City is moving in the way that it is, or at least a number of its officials are now moving to get it onto the official city agenda.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great. Well, we'll be following that. I wondered about, what about the Federal Reserve? I guess they now own 12% of the home mortgage business, with having bought up all these mortgage-backed securities. And yet, they're not really helping homeowners. The idea, supposedly, was to lower the interest rate on home loans, but I don't know that that's worked, and it certainly has helped the banks. It seems like the Fed is just there to serve the banks, and that's who they have served. But what if they were to help the underwater homeowners by actually writing down some of these mortgages that they're holding, or actually zeroing in on the underwater mortgages? Has that ever been raised? Is that just not something they would consider? I mean, there was the Homeowners Loan Corporation in the New Deal that did something similar, bought up mortgages that were going into default. And actually turned a profit, I guess, after a number of years and managed to save the whole housing market.
I'm going to start with what you said last about the Homeowners Loan Corporation, or HOLC. So, interestingly enough, the very first version of this plan that I ever put out there was in 2007, and it expressly called upon the present-day, still-existing successor of HOLC, namely the Federal Housing Administration, or FHA, to conduct the plan, to sort of do this, right? In other words, what for the last 4 or 5 years I've been asking or calling on cities to do and offering to help cities in doing, I originally called upon FHA to do, and FHA is the successor to HOLC. You're exactly right about what HOLC was and what it did. And it's actually significant. A lot of people don't realize this, right? So people know about the stock market crash, right, of 1929 and the stock market bubble that, of course, ultimately ended in that crash. People don't seem to realize that there was also a housing bubble, a real estate bubble in the late 1920s that was kind of paired up with the stock market bubble. And, you know, history indicates that the very worst bubbles and busts and ensuing recessions or depressions are those that simultaneously involve the equities markets on the one hand and the housing markets on the other. And that's, of course, what we had in the lead up to 2007, 2008. And the last time that we had had that had been 8 years earlier in the lead up to 1928, 29. So what that meant in turn is that in addition to all sorts of trouble that was caused by the stock market crash, you had a real serious real estate problem and residential real estate problem back in the early 30s, right after the crash. All of it had to do with a very primitive kind of Rube Goldberg system of private home mortgage finance that we had at the time, a system that we got rid of in the 1930s and didn't see again until, of course, the early 2000s. What do you know? They always say history repeats itself, and it certainly did in this case. So what happened then was, as lots of homeowners were suddenly finding themselves defaulting on their loans, and as banks were finding themselves unable to write those loans down owing to a variety of structural impediments in the late 20s and early 30s, you had a mass homelessness and mass foreclosure and homelessness problem threatening the country, and it was harming the banks too. So what happens when President Roosevelt takes office? He took office in March of 1933. Inauguration Day used to be in March in those days. Within the first 3 months of the Roosevelt administration, there were two particularly important measures that were taken. And it's no accident that it was these two, and they were not unrelated. One was declaring the bank holiday, which we've all heard about because so many banks were failing because their loans were going bad, their portfolios were sinking precisely because the homeowners weren't able to pay their loans any longer. And the second thing they did was to create the Homeowners Loan Corporation, which they did really quickly. So, Roosevelt takes office in March. The HOLC is up and running in June, 3 months later, shortly, right after the bank holiday is declared, right? So as you noted, HOLC was essentially what it was designed to do was to raise funds from private investors. It issued bonds, basically, to private investors and raised funds from other people who had financed that was sort of disposable, right, that they could provide. In that sense, it was a kind of public-private partnership. And it bought up loans off of the books of various banking institutions that couldn't write them down, and then it itself wrote them down. HOLC was, from the inception, meant to do that for only a bit over a year until a more permanent organization could be instituted, right? Because HOLC was kind of an emergency measure. It was just created very quickly without a lot of time to kind of think it all through. And the thought was, Roosevelt, I think, was admirably expeditious about things. He said, look, we got to do something now. We can't wait. So HOLC was up and running again within 3 months of the administration's taking office. Can you imagine? I mean, imagine if Obama had done something like that. If he had done the equivalent after taking office in January of 2009, we would have had some federal agency buying up loans in April of 2009. And indeed, that's exactly what I was calling for then. And I was lucky enough to have an old friend and classmate who was part of the Obama campaign, kind of highly placed and was in the early administration. And they were actively considering it, but ultimately they decided to go a different route. But in any event, HOLC was meant to do what it did for only a little over a year. So it extended its very last loans at the end. It bought its last batch of loans at the end of 1934. Meanwhile, in 1934, a new permanent agency was instituted. This was the Federal Housing Administration, or FHA. And over time, FHA superseded HOLC. It kind of took over its functions. Working in conjunction with Fannie Mae, which was then instituted in 1938 to provide a secondary market, those two organizations, those two outfits, FHA and Fannie Mae, did a number of very important things. But first of all, they stabilized the housing market, and they kept it stable for more than 70 years. And they converted us from a country in which fewer than 40% of families own their own homes to one in which nearly 70% own their own homes. And this system worked like a dream. It worked like a charm. It was stable. It was effective. They introduced the 30-year fixed rate mortgage, which became the dominant mortgage instrument. They provided mortgage insurance, provided that the homes met certain quality conditions and the loans met quality conditions as well. And everything worked actually quite well until the very early 2000s. When all of these private institutions started offering subprime loans and Alt-A loans that they could then bundle and securitize, and in effect they replicated in updated form the forms of kind of Rube Goldberg housing finance that had dominated the 1920s, and that's exactly what got us into trouble, and that's exactly what we're living in the aftermath of.
Can you explain what you mean by that, the Rube Goldberg system that was replicated?
Yeah. So this is essentially those sliced and diced mortgage loans that I was referring to before, you know, the ones that everybody refers to as sliced and diced. This was the private label securitized mortgage loan industry, which offered all kinds of crazy new loan products to lots of people who couldn't understand them, you know, with balloon mortgages that might start with very low interest rates, but then later would have, you know, the rates would suddenly expand or suddenly get higher. Loans where you didn't have to put any money down, loans where not only did you not have to put any money down, but you could actually extract equity from the house you were buying before putting anything down on the house and before making any serious payments. You could, in effect, in other words, extract equity from homes that you didn't own yet on the theory that, well, they're going to go up in value in future in any event, because we're in the middle of a bubble and housing prices, after all, can only go up. These kinds of products were predatorily lit to lots of folk out there in the home buying sector. They were disproportionately targeted at communities of color. African-American and Hispanic borrowers were especially prime targets, if I can, you know, pun a bit, of the subprime lenders. The numbers are kind of startling. Somewhere around 30 to 33% of African-Americans who were steered by mortgage originators into subprime loans actually qualified for prime loans, but were convinced by these kind of high-pressure salespeople that they would be better off buying, you know, the sort of snazzy, exotic mortgage products. And why did they do that? Why did the lenders do that? Well, because higher fees could be earned by the lenders for on those kinds of loans. So it was there was a kind of a crazy sort of wild west of mortgage finance that sort of came to predominate the American home finance markets in the early 2000s. And in many ways, it looked like a kind of latter-day version of some of what you saw going on in the late 1920s in the real estate bubble of that time.
Was there actually securitization in the 20s?
Yeah, there was a kind of prototype, a kind of an early form of securitization. This was an arrangement referred to as the counterpart to the subprime securitized mortgage loan, or the securitized mortgage-backed security of the early 2000s. Back in the 1920s was the so-called mortgage bond financed mortgage lending industry, right? So it was a form of where essentially what you would do is get diffuse investors who would be purchasing bonds to supply the money that was used to extend loans, right? And this made mortgage lending and mortgage credit overabundant for a time in the late 1920s, just as happened in the early 2000s. And as we all know, that which fuels a bubble is an excess of credit of certain kinds, right? It's a tendency for credit to be too cheap in some markets while it's too expensive in others. And you end up getting a form of credit allocation that in an unhealthy way tends to stoke or tends to inflate a bubble in a particular sector. And, of course, the salient sector of our own economy in more recent times was the home mortgage sector or the housing sector. And a similar story is what occurred along with the stock market bubble in the late 1920s.
So on the Federal Reserve, it seems to me I can see why Congress would balk at bailing out the underwater homeowners, because they will say we don't have the money. I mean, that's mm-hmm. always the reason they're not doing much of anything. But mm-hmm. the Federal Reserve has all the money it feels like aiming at some problems. Mm-hmm. So what if, or could they, or is that not within their mandate, or has anybody asked them if they might?
Yeah, so here's the key here. The Fed has done everything, I believe, that it has statutory authorization to do. And what I mean by that is this. What the Fed has done is bought up mortgage-backed securities, right, the bonds that are associated with mortgage loans. It's done that in a number of ways. First, of course, the New York Fed established a couple of funds called the Maiden Lane Funds that bought up those securities when they were being undervalued during the crash in 2008 and 2009 and thereafter. Then the Fed itself, pursuant to its QE3 policies adopted in October of 2012, has been purchasing $85 billion worth, I believe, $85 million.
It's billion, but I think half of it is federal securities, right?
Yeah, so it's been buying up mortgage-backed securities each on a monthly basis as well. And it's been doing that in order to try to keep mortgage interest rates low so that homeowners who are able to refinance their current mortgages will be able to take advantage of lower interest rates. And it's, you know, trying to keep the cost of credit low. The restriction on the Fed here is that it can't get at the loans as distinguished from those bonds any more than anybody else can without an exercise of the eminent domain authority. Because remember, what we're talking about here is it's the source of the problem is the loans rather than the bonds. And the loans are locked in these trusts, right? They can't be voluntarily sold by the trustee because of those contract terms I mentioned before, these pooling and servicing agreements known as PSAs. These contracts prohibit the trustee from selling the troubled loans out of the trust. That means if the Fed approaches the trustee and says, we'd like to buy those troubled loans from you so that we can write them down, the trustee is going to say, well, look, I'd love to help you out here. I'd love to be rid of these loans myself because they're dragging down the value of the portfolio, but the contract will not permit me to sell them. Then the Fed has to say, well, okay, the only way that the Fed could actually buy them anyway, you know, if the trustee said I can't sell them because the contract prohibits me, would be for the Fed to use eminent domain authority. And, of course, you know, it's not going to do that unless Congress authorizes it. But if Congress were ready to authorize that, it would be much more efficient for Congress to authorize FHA to use federal eminent domain authority to buy those loans. And that's exactly why the first form of this plan that I first pitched back in 2007, 2008 was precisely for that to happen. It was precisely for FHA to use federal eminent domain authority to buy these loans out of the trusts in order to be able to write them down.
But wouldn't they actually have to come up with the money, whereas the Federal Reserve can just create it on their books?
The thing is, FHA would have to come up with the money, but there's no reason that that couldn't itself come indirectly from the Fed, right? I mean, the Fed can effectively finance government operations by buying up Treasury securities. Now, it's not permitted to do that directly, of course, but it purchases U.S. Treasury securities indirectly all the time in its open market operations from various dealer banks, from private banking institutions. So it would be easy enough, right, for Treasury to fund FHA's purchase of these things and essentially to issue more Treasury debt. And then, of course, the Fed would could indirectly buy up that Treasury debt. But, of course, you won't see this Congress allowing that, unfortunately.
Well, and the other thing is, it seems to me that then it would be a debt. In other words, mm-hmm. it's a debt
right.
to the government, whereas if the Federal Reserve just does like they're doing now with quantitative easing, there's nobody owes the money, right? They just printed it.
Yeah, I mean, at least the thing that people don't recognize, when the Federal Reserve creates money, people don't think of money as being a debt. But strictly speaking, any currency, right? Any sovereign currency is a liability of the sovereign, right? So there's a sense in which that would be debt too. It's just that, you know, for various reasons, we tend to recognize treasury bills as debt obligations, but we don't recognize dollars as liabilities that the government has. But from an accounting point of view, there's very little difference between the two things. There's very little difference between a Federal Reserve note, which is what your dollar bill is. If you pull it out of your pocket and look, it'll say Federal Reserve note. There's very little accounting difference. There's very little financial difference between a Federal Reserve note on the one hand and a Treasury bill on the other. The one is legal tender, of course. You can buy stuff with a dollar bill. But treasury bills are likewise, in a certain sense, legal tender, in the sense that lots of transactions are conducted with them. It's just that they're conducted by large financial institutions. And treasury bills are regularly monetized in the so-called repo markets, right? This is the way many large financial institutions get their short-term funding for the investment activities they engage in, is they essentially sell treasuries to some other institution and combine that sale with an agreement to purchase the thing back the following day at a slightly higher price, which is the interest rate, in effect, that institution is paying. So the repo markets are effectively monetizing in a very direct, almost legal tenderish sort of way, treasury debt itself. So you're right as far as the sort of the optics go. Optically speaking, treasury bills are experienced or thought of by people as debt obligations, whereas money is not. But strictly speaking, both are liabilities of the federal government, and both can be issued ad libitum without causing any trouble for the federal fisc for as long as there remains slack in the economy, which of course there does right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it seems to me, though, there's a psychological difference. Like, you're not mm-hmm. going to get Congress to raise the debt ceiling that much.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But if it's just printed money and the Federal Reserve does it, Congress has no control over the Federal Reserve except to the extent that it's not in the act. They have mm-hmm. control over what they wrote in the Federal Reserve Act, but within those strictures, the Fed can do what it wants, and it brags about being able to do what it wants.
When you say there's a psychological difference, that's sort of what I mean when I talk about the optics being different, right? Some people experience these two things as different. Second, it's true, of course, that the Fed has authorization, of course, to increase the money supply, and there's no direct control over it by Congress. However, there is considerable indirect control exercised by Congress, and they exercise a kind of an indirect influence, I believe, over some Fed decision makers the louder they get. And, of course, they then threaten to pass further legislation that would, you know, hamstring or further restrict the Fed. The third point is on the debt ceiling. I've got an op-ed on this that I put out last October in Reuters. It's called "The Budget Is Its Own Debt Ceiling." I firmly believe that the debt ceiling itself is invalid. It is not real law. And I believe that if the administration were to challenge the debt ceiling in court, let's say Congress refused to raise it. Let's say, you know, all hell breaks loose and Republicans actually regain control of the Senate, which I think would be an absolute and utter unmitigated disaster for the country. Let's just suppose in a sort of science fiction mode that the Republicans got control of the Senate again in coming midterm elections in 2015 and then refused to raise the debt ceiling. I've argued, and I would continue to argue, and I'm in good company here. A lot of very distinguished legal scholars, including my own colleague Mike Dorf and Neil Buchanan, have argued that the debt ceiling is just not, they say it's the least illegal option. I actually think it's the only legal option, is essentially to ignore the debt ceiling.
And I agree with you. We're almost out of time, but I had to see if I can just slip in two more quick questions. GDP has actually gone negative in the first quarter, which means we're in a recession if mm-hmm. that keeps up for two quarters. So I just wonder what the numbers are, like how many homes are underwater and to what extent do you think mm-hmm. that affects GDP, and how would it turn things around if we were able to escape that mm-hmm. issue?
Okay. That's a really, really great question. So first, the underwater mortgage loan problem is scarcely any better than it was in 2007 and 2008. There's been some improvement, but because the problem has been locally concentrated from the start, And because the hardest hit cities and other localities have scarcely changed at all, the problem remains huge. As far as numbers go, 20% of all outstanding mortgage loans are significantly underwater. Another 20% have so little positive equity in them that they are tantamount to being underwater once you factor in the various costs that come when it comes to, say, selling a home or trying to move to a place where there are more jobs. It ends up being almost functionally equivalent to being underwater. So that means you've got 40% of the nation's outstanding mortgage loans with little to no to negative home equity, and that is itself the problem. That's the first point. Second point is that operates as an absolutely and utterly huge drag, by far the greatest drag on economic growth. And the reason is very simple. Homeowners are, by and large, the affected homeowners are for the most part in the middle class and sort of lower middle class, lower income to middle income folk. These people are by far the principal source of consumer spending power in our economy. Consumer spending power, in turn, is that which stimulates economic growth and employment. So if those people aren't spending, economic growth, of course, is going to slow and even go into negative territory from time to time. That's going to lead also to unemployment, which, of course, then worsens the problem because when people lose their jobs, they're even less able to stay current on their mortgage payments. So you can get a very terrible sort of negative downward spiral. And for that reason, we remain in the doldrums. The economy continues either in recession or in a malaise. It's very close to recession precisely because of this problem. No amount of stimulus can correct for this problem. There's only one solution to it, and that's to write down the mortgage debt. That's the only way. Another, to harken back for a moment to the 20s and 30s, Americans have not only forgotten that there was a housing bubble and bust in the 20s and 30s, just as there was a stock market bubble and bust, they've also forgotten the greatest American economist of the era, of the 20th century, who wrote the most important and insightful works on what the cause of the Depression was. That's the great economist Irving Fisher. But Fisher said all of this. He said basically what happens, that which causes a depression or a really long lingering recession, is a lot of people get into debt when they're purchasing assets in a market where there's a bubble underway. Once the assets crash, the debts don't. So people live massively with debt overhang. They stop spending. The economy grinds to a halt or slows to a very anemic rate of growth, and unemployment ends up being a lingering and enduring problem. And there's only one way out of it, and that's to reduce that debt overhang, to cut that debt. Corporations, by the way, do this all the time. When corporations get into trouble, we have something called bankruptcy for them. And when they go bankrupt, that doesn't mean that they cease to exist. It's not the death penalty for the firm. It means the firm restructures its debt obligations. Some of the debt has to be written off. Then the firm continues on its merry way. Some creditors had to take a hit. That's all there is to it. But, you know, the creditors are usually pretty well-heeled people. So when they lose something, it doesn't drain spending power out of the economy. But, you know, ironically, the people who need this most and the people who, when they don't get it, harm the economy most are precisely the ones who don't get it. They don't get bankruptcy protection for home mortgage loans in the way that corporations do for business loans. So until we rectify that, and by the way, as a quick aside, you know, in defense of this, of the Obama administration, they did try in 2009 and 2010 to get the bankruptcy code changed by Congress to allow for home mortgages to be included, but they failed in Congress with that. And so I applaud them for having tried to do that, but I fault them for not having fallen back to eminent domain once that particular effort failed. Because until we do it, until some authority uses its eminent domain power to start taking these loans at fair value and writing them down, we're going to continue in the doldrums that we're in. It's just going to go on and on like this.
My last article that I wrote was on the fact that central banks are now buying up equities, buying up stock. Not the U.S. central bank, but particularly China is a big leader. And Switzerland is doing it. So, it seems to me that my question is really just on my own conceptualization on this. Maybe I've got it wrong. That when the Chinese central bank it prints yuan and trades those yuan with the dollars that the Chinese merchants have acquired selling products. So the dollars are legitimately there, but the yuan have been printed. just out of nothing, just like printing dollars. And then so the merchants have been paid. They've been paid in yuan, which they need to pay their workers and to pay for their suppliers. And that so the central bank, in effect, has all these dollars for free. I mean, it's just as if they had printed them. And now they're using them to buy up companies, which is a bit shocking, the fact that they could buy up companies in America or major companies. What is there to stop a central bank from just printing its own currency, trading it on the exchange market for whatever at the going rate, using some other country's currency to buy up their assets? And what if there were competitive wars doing this? It seems to me our whole system is fundamentally flawed in that respect, but maybe I'm not looking at it right.
No, I mean, I think you're right in the sense that this vulnerability is definitely there, right? There's no question but that it is, in fact, there. We have a way on the books of dealing with the problem when it is concentrated in certain categories of business endeavor that we have already designated as sort of national security concern, right? What that means, I think, is that in the long run, we're probably going to have to broaden the definition of national security concern so as to be able to use the same measures in other industries. So what do I mean by that? Well, there are some industries that have long since been kind of categorically designated as being sort of sensitive from a national security point of view. Media is one. Of course, arms manufacturers are another. Certain sort of sensitive areas in the high-tech sector have also been categorically designated as being of national security interest. And what that means in turn is that there are federal legal limitations on foreign government involvement in those sectors, or even foreign firms' involvement in those sectors, right? So if a Chinese company or a Chinese state-owned enterprise were to try to buy up a big part of, say, Lockheed Martin or something, it simply wouldn't be able to do that. You might recall, furthermore, back in 2005, the Chinese state petroleum company was going to buy a huge stake in some American petroleum companies in order to be able to do some oil prospecting in the Gulf of Mexico. There was a huge national outcry in the summer of 2005 here in the States about that, because this industry hadn't already been included in the kind of category of national security sensitive firms. So there were calls in Congress to have that industry added. The Chinese kind of savvily realized that, you know, they better get out of here, or else that they're going to feel a change in the law in the States that might affect them even worse than, you know, this one industry. And so they pulled out and sort of rescinded their offer. But I think if you see more and more of this happening in other industries, we'll probably see, or hopefully we would see, a kind of a reawakening of that same concern that briefly flowered in the summer of 2005. As people became concerned about the possibility of a government that might end up being hostile to us, and in certain ways already is clearly hostile to us, gaining control of firms that, you know, ideally we would like to think of as being controlled by Americans or by the American government or both.
Well, I can see not allowing them to buy certain things, but it seems to me even if they're buying innocuous things, the very idea that they can print money and buy our things shows that there's a flaw in this money printing system, which, I mean, I think it's good that countries can issue their own money. So I'm not just sure how to integrate those two, but it seems to me globally we need a new system of exchange.
I think that's right. I mean, the thing is, insofar as we look at the problem through that particular lens, which I think you just described really, really terrifically well, what it sort of underscores is the sort of craziness, the lunacy of having a system where you effectively have a global economy without actually having a global currency, right? You've got various national currencies that are backed up by various national sovereigns, which sovereigns, in turn, are not controlled by any global government or any sort of global regime when it comes to monetary arrangements. And that is a sort of recipe for dysfunction. At various times in world history, we have seen that dysfunction come into play and manifest itself with terrible end results, right? I mean, one way of looking at the dysfunctions of the 1930s that ultimately culminated in World War is as essentially a global currency system run amok, right, where you had lots of different nations competing with one another, sort of engaged in so-called competitive devaluations of their currencies relative to one another in order to try to get a leg up on one another in global trading arrangements. And that, of course, ended up, you know, causing global chaos in the financial markets, in the national macroeconomies, and ultimately in the world as a whole, in such a way as that kind of paved the way to the rise of dysfunctional, kind of crazy, atavistic governments like those of the fascists in Italy and the Nazis in Germany. And in a sense, we have something kind of similar now, right? The Fed is a kind of de facto central bank to the world, even when it doesn't want to be, because of the role of the dollar in the global economy. In some ways, that inures to American advantage, and in other ways, it inures to American disadvantage. You know, the disadvantage is clearly that if the dollar is in high demand, it comes to be overvalued relative to American goods, and so that American goods aren't competitive with other goods in global goods markets. The sense in which it's an advantage, sort of, in the short run, is that the Americans can kind of borrow indefinitely from the world because there seems to be an insatiable demand for U.S. dollars, which are effectively American liabilities. But you know, in the long run, that's probably not healthy either. And one way of looking at what you just described China is doing is that China's sort of beginning to notice ways that it can kind of take advantage of this sort of anarchic global currency system in the way that the Americans themselves have done at certain times, right? Again, sometimes for the good and sometimes for ill. I think what that means is for the long term is that ultimately we need some kind of global currency regime that the nations of the world can agree on that basically ensures some kind of uniformity across jurisdictions, that ensures adequate global liquidity on the one hand and eliminates the need for competitive currency gaming on the other hand. And, you know, interestingly and ironically, that was initially what John Maynard Keynes had in mind for what became the IMF. The IMF we have is very different from that we were supposed to have as originally designed by J.M. Keynes in 1944, what he called an international clearing union. And I think, in a way, one way of looking at what we're living through now and have lived through ever since the 1940s is the consequences of not having gone the original Keynesian route with the IMF and having gone a different route instead.
I would agree with that. Yeah, I actually have a theory on that. Well, I wrote this before I examined different theories and saw what it looked to me like the best solution was to have a global yardstick for measuring the value of currencies. So you're not actually trading in any particular currency, and but it's like you can measure, you can transfer from inches to meters, and you can transfer from different measures in different systems. But there's no way to transfer from dollars to pounds to pesos and get a good value. It's all too fluctuating. But what you could do is take a basket of things that everybody needs, including commodities, including maybe housing, if you can figure out how to measure it. I mean, we already have cost of living data that comes up regularly. It wouldn't be that hard to determine. And then you would measure your to have a currency unit and measure what that currency unit would buy in this country and what it would buy in that country. And therefore, on that system, you could continue to, if you wanted to inflate your currency, fine, that was your business. And if that would just devalue the currency, but it would show up in the yardstick compared to other currencies.
Yeah, so there are a couple of attempts at something much like that that are out there already, but they don't play the role that you're envisaging, basically because we don't have a regime that provides the context that would be necessary, I suppose, for that to be done in some kind of a globally tracked way. But on the one hand, there's, of course, the so-called purchasing power parity measure, or the sort of PPP measure, where global economists will come up with a basket of basic goods and commodities, and then they'll track relative currency values using that basket as a kind of benchmark. And another way that sort of a slightly less satisfactory, but a kind of a related effort that you sometimes find is essentially this is done by the IMF, where you'll have a basket of currencies themselves and sort of track individual currencies relative to that basket as a whole. You sort of create an index or formulate an index from that basket. I think the reason that these kind of alternative measures that are sometimes used don't have the kind of traction that you're envisaging, but there's no official policy followed by any national government or any particular international organization that affects everybody's lives and makes essential reference to a benchmark of this kind. Were there to be that, I think we would effectively have a kind of global currency regime that was a little bit less Wild West, a little bit less anarchic than what we have now. The way things are now is, you know, they're not quite anarchic in the sense that there's a well-established sort of set of norms pursuant to which various national central banks kind of coordinate when taking various measures, and they kind of keep each other apprised of things, and even meet regularly over as part of the Basel Committee over at the Bank for International Settlements in Basel. And the whole idea there is to kind of keep each other apprised and to be sort of considerate of one another and not just sort of do things unilaterally without warning. But that's not exactly you know, what you would call a fully developed legal regime, right? That would be more like, instead of having a federal government here in the States, having the governors of the various states, you know, kind of regularly sit down and talk about what they're planning on doing in their states. Okay. It's not exactly governance. It's better than pure anarchy, but it's still not really quite what you would call governance.
So a lot of people are saying that the dollar is about to crash because China and Russia and are dealing in their own currencies and not dealing with the dollar anymore. But as you mentioned, there are advantages and disadvantages to being the reserve currency. So what do you see as the fate of the dollar in the next couple of years?
So one can't ever be complacent and can't expect that just as a matter of metaphysical truth that the dollar will always be, you know, the global reserve currency or the currency of last resort or what have you. But that being said, I don't think that there's anything out there right now to give one any strong reason to think that any other currency is in the near future going to be displacing the dollar. I don't think the renminbi, in other words, in the foreseeable future could realistically serve as a rival to the dollar. And I certainly don't think that the ruble in the foreseeable future could do that. Now, I don't know, maybe 20 years hence or 25 years hence, that could change. Hopefully, though, in that interval, you know, we will have actually kind of figured things out here at home a bit and sort of put our own house in order, so to speak, and solved, you know, some of our currently intractable looking problems in such a way as to kind of keep the dollar stable and something that people can be confident in. If you think about it, I mean, I think ultimately the value of a particular currency in the eyes of people worldwide is probably a function of several sort of interrelated factors, right? One is, you know, the portion of the world economy that the nation that issues the currency sort of represents, right? Another is the reliability of the government of that particular country to sort of live up to its promises, to do what it says it's going to do. Another is the reliability of that government to sort of be able to do what it claims to want to do. And then finally, another is the sort of the coherence of that government as sort of representing a polity, right, a nation full of people who at least agree on enough basic fundamentals as to enable a government to kind of have continuity of policy, at least with respect to certain basic fundamental matters. I think the U.S. obviously, you know, does pretty well on some of those measures, but does a bit poorly these days on some others of those dimensions. And the key point then becomes, all right, does any other country look likely to be able to sort of outperform the U.S. on the sum total of those particular measures, those particular dimensions? At present, it doesn't look likely, right? China is, you know, becoming a rough counterpart to the United States in terms of, you know, how big a portion of the world economy it accounts for. It's also, to some extent, comparable to the U.S. with respect to the kind of capacity of its government to follow through on things that it says it's going to do. On the other hand, I do think that there's a lot of deep internal instability in the Chinese economy and the Chinese financial system, and that ultimately could end up manifesting itself in political dysfunction in China as well. I don't think China is as kind of rock solid, reliable as a stable polity as some people think it is. I think there's a lot of sources of internal difficulty there, many of them financial. And then relatedly, I think China is still in many ways a kind of renegade state or a kind of rogue state in some ways that makes it a little bit less predictable to people, and therefore makes people, I think, a little bit less willing to sort of trust it to do everything that it says it's going to do. You know, the latest, if you just think in terms of what it's been doing in the South China Sea lately, some of that stuff is kind of shocking and rather destabilizing, right? I mean, the sort of reliability of a national currency is partly dependent not just on the power and the influence of the country that issues the currency, but also on the boringness of that country, so to speak, you know, the predictability of that country. And China's been acting in some kind of erratic and less predictable ways lately.
I think we have been too, but feel that the dollar is not in danger at the moment. But.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And I certainly don't mean to give the U.S. a free pass on any of this. I mean, we've done some really unbelievably nutty things lately. And my God, I mean, 3 or 4 years ago, nobody ever would have imagined in a million years, right, that the U.S. might actually talk about reneging on its debt, you know, by not raising the debt ceiling. We can thank Eric Cantor for having made us look a little bit more like China to the rest of the world, I think, ever after 2011.
Well, thank you so much. It's been really interesting.
It's always wonderful to talk to you. I mean, the conversations are always so interesting, and they're about so many issues that don't get enough intelligent discussion, I think, and it's really fun to talk to you about these things.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's great to have an opportunity to ask who has been there and knows the insiders and can really answer those questions.
It's always feel like productive conversations.
Right.
Thanks so much again.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Okay, bye for now.
That was Robert Hockett, professor at Cornell University, talking about eminent domain and many other interesting things.
That's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to today's guest, Professor Bob Hockett of Cornell University. You can find out more about this and other issues surrounding the world of money by visiting Ellen's Web of Debt blog at ellenbrown.com. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another installment of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, as well as a look at developments on the public banking front. For more information about public banking, please go to publicbankinginstitute.org. On behalf of Ellen Brown, this is Walt McCree. Thanks for listening.